Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you are listening from. It is nice, or I guess watching, it's nice to see your smiling faces. That's right, we have a video version of this podcast. It goes out to all of the people that support on patreon.com/thedailyBA. This is an extension of a video YouTube Facebook channel that I run, essentially, that is meant to be a daily behavior analytic upload of some sort of nature. Just give you a little bit of escapism, some sort of cool resource, cool thoughts, things like that. So with that said, today we are jumping in on mental health with Tina Patterson. Ran across her through Patreon, actually. I got to know her last year, and she has a lot of thoughts when it comes to mental health. A lot of experience that is an area is completely outside of my own and Dimitri's. So it felt like this really good fit to have a conversation, see where things go. So this is like our first installment of a mental health episode. We will, of course, revisit this. We already have plans with a few other colleagues. And we're just going to try to work out the details over the summer for multiple episodes along this nature. So first of all, I'm going to let her introduce herself. We captured this beforehand.
I've lived and worked in Nashville for 25 years. I went back to school and got my graduate degree at Vanderbilt, as I said, with Craig Kennedy. Sure. I worked in research for a while and then discovered that, and I published in experimental analysis for a long time. So that was really about looking at operant and respondent responses from mice and medication. So it was behavioral pharmacology for a few years.
Oh, fascinating.
But then I got a grant. And I got to work out in the schools again. And I was special ed teacher before I went back to grad school. And so I went back to the schools and started working, had grants to pay me and all that. So when the grants were wrapping up and I was wrapping up my research job, the schools and residential partnerships didn't want me to go. And so I tell everybody that was 20 years ago and I became accidentally self-employed and I've been looking for a job ever since. So,
all right, with that said, we're just going to roll that intro. Thank you for listening. Let's go.
Because you guys, this is where my passion is. And wherever I go, this is what I'm hearing and this is what I'm learning is that about, and the numbers are showing out. Do you guys know about SAMHSA? Anyway, so we could talk about the substance abuse website for the government. Anyway, we've got some numbers now. 70%, upwards of 70%. Of people with autism and developmental disabilities have a co-occurring mental health condition. We're not talking about this. We're lumping all behaviors into the autism box if they have an autism diagnosis, right? So we've got to be able to separate out what is autism and what is anxiety. What is autism and what is depression, right? Sure. So this is kind of where my passion lies is that we've not been treating the children with mental illness.
Okay. Well, let's, do you want to go ahead and start there? Because I don't know if we'll necessarily disagree hard. I think that I think that we might have a little bit of a discussion though on that, on the way the topographies and the behaviors play out and stuff. And let's just roll.
Absolutely.
I love it.
Yeah. And
absolutely.
I'll probably be asking questions for clarification because I'm not an expert in these areas to the extent that you are.
All right, let's do it.
Rock and roll. Let's go. So, I mean, honestly, I feel like we're probably going to use already a lot of the stuff we talked about just because it was so good. you crushed your intro so good. I'm not going to lie, Tina. I hope all our guests are like you. You were, number one, prepared, but eloquent and just salient and so cogent. Thank you, for real. So good.
I didn't even know we were rolling.
but yeah.
Let's start the discussion around mental health. It is a huge topic. But that is the reason that we're here. We're gonna go on a journey across a couple different topics. So to everyone listening out there, buckle up, get ready. We will see where we're at when we end this. How are you doing today, Tina?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
For sure. All right. So we've already warmed up the conversation a little bit. Where do we want to start with mental health?
Well, I think what I'd like to do is kind of jump in on the history, a little bit of ABA, right? Let's talk about where we started back in the 60s. Right. And where we started was in the mental health institutions. Right. We were helping people by analyzing what was happening with them in those institutional settings and helping them find independence, communication, and a place to live. And so now it seems that the tide has turned a little bit, and we focus really heavily on developmental disabilities, and we've kind of forgotten a little bit about what's happening with our populations of mental health. And what do I mean by that? Well, if the CDC is right, in 2012, they submitted a report that said one in five children, school-age children, have a mental illness, and one in four adults. So that's 25% of the adult population in America. And that's amazing, right? And 20% of children. Now, if you go and look at the statistics for special ed in your district, at the school report card, it's not going to be 20%. It's going to be less than 10%. So where are these kids? Where are they? And are how come they're not being helped in this day and age? So if we have one in five with a mental illness, and what is mental illness defined by the CDC? Well, it's anxiety, depression, bipolar, which is considered different than depression, schizophrenia, but in children it looks like a mood disorder like psychosis, and Tourette syndrome. They also have ADHD on that spectrum. And here's what we know, guys, and this is the beautiful part. About 5 years ago, they found the gene. They found the gene for schizophrenia. And on the same gene, they found bipolar and they found ADHD. They're all on the same gene. They're right next door to each other. So it has a biological component, right? So when did BCBAs, when did ABA stop looking at biology? Right? Why are we afraid of respondent behavior? Why are we afraid of this?
Yeah, so in case we have some folks new to the field real quick here, let's step back just a second. Like the respondent behavior is that like involuntary actions is how it's typically talked about. You have some sort of stimulus response paradigm that's going on there. It's like the antecedent R part, but it's in the respondent world. And then the operant side, controlled by consequences, can be very different there, right? The way that that operates. Mental health is traditionally, so we have the roots there, we can unpack that, but we also have just a quick note on like mentalism, right? So traditionally we've had a pretty staunch fields approach on things of this nature. When we're talking about depression, anxiety, these things are labels, they are categories of, I would say, a lot of different behavior. And this causes issues for behavior analysts because it's not actually looking, it's two things. It's either not actually looking at the behavior itself, like refining down to what the behavior is, or it is imposing this sort of dual world, right? Where there's two different worlds. One is where behavior can occur and like we can, in a sense, use natural science and understand what's going on. But the other one is this mental world that all of a sudden is totally inaccessible and usually operates on totally different principles. And that just falls out of a realm of science for us. So the flight from those sort of natural situations has always been super interesting to me. We have some pretty cool, you remind me of like the anxiety article by Pat Fryman and Hayes and Wilson. I think it was like 92 or something like that, where they were, there's some really good conceptualizations of this, right? But my first thought is we're not creating two things, the training programs around those applications, right? Like, so we're not saying, hey, young behavior analyst, you could pursue something like this.
Right.
We're also not creating like tools and technology developed around that either.
Right.
With the exception of like ACT and that whole world.
Right, right. So what I do is I like to break it down when I do an RBT course and when I'm teaching paraprofessionals in the school district and families and teachers and educators, I like to tell them this, listen, let's just keep it simple. There are two types of behaviors. There's learned behavior and there's unlearned behavior. And what I want to talk to you today about is the unlearned behavior. And let me talk about some examples. Sneezing. I can observe sneezing. I can count sneezing, but that is not a learned behavior. Okay. I can see someone demonstrating a visual or auditory hallucination, but that is not a learned behavior, right? I can see the effects of depression, what the behavior of depression looks like, what moodiness might look like. And so what I like to talk about with people is, remember, these can be defined because we can do operational definitions around symptoms of mental disorders, right? So what I'm talking about is really understanding what's going on in the brain right? And understanding what parts are those learned pieces and what parts are not those learned pieces. And then still, how do you develop a behavior plan? And how do you work with other people to make a whole system of support work?
Yeah, I guess I'm with you that there is a respondent nature to some of that stuff, but and I think what you're describing is the way that I would articulate it more as there are aspects of certain types of behavioral response classes that emerge connected to the genetic endowment, because I think that's what Skinner would say, versus the ones shaped through consequences. I would argue that even ones that might have a respondent look to them, though, still have, depending on the functional relation, the function that they serve, could still be learned. Like sneezing could be problematic if it's done in an attempt to escape or avoid responding, right? Or any of those types of things. And anxiety, too, can also be conditioned in terms of like, I mean, well, trauma is a prime example of conditioning anxiety. It's not necessarily respondent. It might become very quickly able to be triggered, like almost instantaneously, but it's still conditioned through a consequence, which makes it operant, not respondent. So I definitely agree with you that we need to have more conversations about these types of complex behavioral things, because that's I see a massive, just continual conceptual mistake that happens in the field there. I'm not sure if I'm totally with you on kind of like looking at them as this innate thing a little bit. Not mostly because I'm afraid of the slippery slope that might lead to in the wrong hands, especially given some of the lack of sophistication in terms of practice. Yep. You see what I mean?
Because I'm completely with you.
Okay, because there's a risk of sliding into mentalism here. There really is. Well, and I know that seems like, you know.
Well, what I really want to encourage you to do is look at the literature and the research from the Center of the Developing Child at Harvard University.
Sure. Okay.
They have some excellent YouTube videos on how the brain actually rewires based on trauma in the environment.
Sure.
Now, Dimitri, I want to say I agree with everything you just said.
Sure.
This is not a topic for newly minted BCBAs to jump into.
For sure.
This is for our researchers. This is for our veterans, right? These are for people who have had many years of experience and have been trained by psychiatrists and psychologists, sure, right? We work together hand in hand. But the evidence is overwhelming. And if you need to look at some of the research, let's talk about the 1998 study on adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah, just one real thing is just one thing just to interject here, just for listeners, if they're interested in just like, because what you're really describing is the connection between operantly controlled behavior or operant behavior and neurology, right? So how does the external affect the internal and the actual biological responses that we experience towards it? So I definitely agree that we have a lack of knowledge and education in neuroanatomy. So here's I'm going to put it on the screen. So if you're seeing this, here's the book. It's old and it's a cheap textbook, but it's a really basic thing if you want to learn more about neuroanatomy. It's called Neuroanatomy for Students of Behavioral Disorders. It's by Ronald Green and Robin Ostrander. And if anything, it gives you a sense and understanding some of the biological implications of some of these things. And there's also a great book out currently called Behave that attempts to really talk about all the different neurochemistry and biochemistry involved. Again, I'm not an expert on this topic. I'm just fascinated by it too.
Sure.
So,
well, and what I wanted to do is jump in and say, when you start jumping in on reading the research on trauma, and that it's not new, and that it's becoming more popular all of a sudden, because what we're experiencing is the results of trauma. And I don't know if you've ever actually taken a trauma test. You can actually look at your ACEs score, and the higher your score, the more likely you are to have some sort of medical condition later in life. And it's been proven. It's been shown over and over. And Philadelphia, Children's Hospital, just updated that study. And so when I look across and I look at the research from Georgetown University and the Children's Service System out of New Jersey and other advocacy organizations that are actually now looking at what is happening with mental health, there's a government website called the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It's shortened by SAMHSA, SAMHSA.org, And that's a government website, and they it's a government agency that actually tracks what's happening in our areas of mental health. And this is what these researchers are reporting, that upwards of 70% of people with autism and developmental disabilities have a co-occurring psychiatric disorder, like anxiety, depression, and others. And where my concern lies is specifically, why aren't we operationalizing this and providing services to children to get the help that they need? And that's a rhetorical question. I think I know why. Right? So if a child shows up at school with an articulation problem, they do a speech assessment and they assign a speech pathologist. Or if a child shows up with a walking disorder, they do an assessment and they get an occupational therapist. But if a child shows up with a mood disorder, or if a child shows up with anxiety disorders, they don't get any mental health, by and large. Some school districts are better than others.
I got to ask the question, just in relation to trauma. There's one, just like, and this is just like the dogmatic behavior analyst in me. So I'm just going to ask it because I'm pretty sure if most of the people that listen to our kind of podcast are pretty hardcore about this stuff. So there's going to be some dogmatism involved. But I mean, like, let's just take for argument's sake, all the things that you're saying are true. And I absolutely agree. I actually believe they're true. Unequivocally, as far as from a neuroscientist perspective, the biological, the genetic endowment piece, the statistics in and of themselves too. From a behavioral point of view, does it really matter though? Because we're talking about just labels, or we're talking about a collection of response classes articulated in a particular sense. If we're talking about our role being agents of behavior change, then don't we just need to understand the functional relations controlling the particular behavior as it's occurring in time, and then we intervene to change that? Not that the context doesn't matter, but that kind of hanging our hat or hyper-focusing on some of those extraneous components maybe muddy the waters in terms of intervention.
My first thought is, behaviorally, we can tackle this. Then it becomes a matter of practicality, right? Do we have the appropriate systems in place to train people, right? The answer there would be no. Like, you can't go. I mean, unless you go to a specific lab with a specific researcher. But is there a systematic, like, organized way to go and get this sort of training in our field? Not like there is for, say, early intervention, functional communication training applications, like functional behavior assessments, like all that whole side of the world. I think the exception here we'll have to talk about at some point is like the acceptance and commitment therapy route and that third wave behavioral training. That's right. My first thoughts.
Right. I think to address your thoughts, Dimitri, I agree. I mean, I can't help but say I agree. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. We are not talking about people who are just going through the task list and passing their exam. We're talking about a scope of competence, not sure. Just a scope of practice.
Yeah. I think the conceptual piece, though, matters too, honestly, because what I get concerned about is even like, actually, let's just go totally off script here. I mean, narrative matters, I think. You know what I mean? Narrative kind of matters. So how we describe problems in general, whether it's on an individual or cultural, societal level, frames how we're going to approach the problem. It frames usually our starting point. It frames where we're going to anchor our assumptions, our presuppositions. It also puts what limitations might be in place, right? It creates the lines that we need to color in, you know? So I feel that sometimes when we talk about mental health disorder specifically outside of the behavioral sense, you almost create this Wild West conceptual framework that opens itself up to pseudoscience a lot more.
That scares me a little bit. Not at all. But I think the task list also does require that we are aware of sleep disorders, that we are aware of pharmacological issues. Absolutely. These are also tapping into that neurological piece, right?
And just so you know, the only reason I'm playing devil's advocate here is because I've been through this emotional transformation in my own practice in the last 2 years, because a lot of my need has shifted to kids that more would fit that conduct disorder, you know, oppositional, almost even BPD type scenario, right? Borderline personality stuff that is really complex verbal repertoires, really complex functions of behavior, really complex presentation. And like the it's you can't a clean three-term contingency isn't there, right? You need to be able to do a multivariate analysis to understand what you're looking for.
That's right.
And our practice in autism and the task list is incredibly limiting being able to conceptualize behavior in that way.
Well, I would like to just tap into what Ryan was saying earlier, and I guess where the lab where I was trained, so with Craig Kennedy at Vanderbilt, we were heavily trained in neurointegrative science. So that was my background, right? So now as a practitioner out in the field, I see it over and over and over again being missed.
You can see that all over. So some fun things to kind of rattle off. Like the one thing we haven't talked about here yet would be epigenetics, and it's the role that your environment plays on the way in which your genetic expression occurs. Things literally right now, like this conversation could be impacting, like theoretically here, could be impacting the way that genes are expressed, like within the lifetime of a person, which is just completely mind-blowing. But this epigenetic behaviorism was first talked about by a behavior analyst in the 40s called Ziyang Guo. Are you kidding me? Dropped and lost, right? I got it on my
camera too for people.
The work that Israel Goldiamond was doing, which is so up this route of mental health. He worked with people with mental health disorders, like their lab was. And the point here is to use some examples. We can point to others if we wanted to, including yours, Tina, that there are extremely well-trained practitioners that came from those camps. And I don't know any other way to say it other than what we did is we standardized the way that our field traditionally approaches teaching and training future behavior analysts to not include those seminal pieces of work outside of there. Now, I don't know if that was because it wasn't in vogue, that it isn't, quote, simplistic enough. I get told a lot that things need to be so simplistic for people when they're first learning. But we forget that, like, these people have shown up for a master's degree. Like, you have shown up for a freaking master's degree, and you're saying that I still need to break things down in the most simplistic ways possible. Yeah. And that's not... To finish this, that's not to say that we don't need to be speaking simplistically. It's to say that you need to have the right model to be able to understand how to approach the situation.
Yeah,
and definitely. When we're talking about something with mental health, we know that an ABC model is not going to be the way, most likely, for us to approach these sort of things. And this was documented by people in our field. Goldiamond said it so eloquently. I'm going to paraphrase, but it was something to the effect of, if you have a simple model, the world is going to look very complex. But if you start with a very thorough, complex model, the world looks very simple. And that's it. Like, we're missing the fact that we have the tools and technologies out there in our past, and we're not orienting the key people in this environment to be able to work on getting those out there.
I think the best analogy to what you're talking about is the difference between Newtonian mechanics and quantum physics. Okay. It really
I don't
is.
Know those.
you have like base principles of mass and force that are really straightforward, and then you have things that can exist and not exist at the same time, and your brain can't handle it. Okay, that's the difference, and the math for it all looks different.
And human
behavior, I think, fits within that paradigm.
And just
you know what I mean?
Yeah. If I want to give an example for folks real quick, think about, as you're listening to this, how many different streams of behavior you're engaging in simultaneously, with how many different antecedents and consequences there are occurring there, and then start to multiply that on how this could be impacting your genes and vice versa. Multiply that on how that is impacting your continual learning history, that is kind of this like summation of who you are and what's going on. The way that language impacts that, we know that language now impacts all of these relations as well when we're talking about anything with language. And this complexity is missed. And I think at the heart of mental health, I believe that the heart of mental health is all of these things coming together.
It's a holistic perspective towards behavior in humans, man.
It really is. And as far as the conceptual framework, I really think that it guides us. But I just finished a peak level one training. And nice. I have to tell you guys, it changed my world because of relational frame theory. And I went back and started reading everything from 2000 and 2001.
Nice.
I'm like, what? That is neurobiological. When you're talking about derived relational responding, the six levels, yeah. of let's teach our kids to problem solve. So what you and I are talking about right now about this is outside of people's scope of reference and scope of, guess what, y'all? In 2 years, everybody's going to need to know it.
Yeah.
Everybody's going to need to know it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, if they want to keep making a living, they're going to need to for sure. Because eventually right? special ed DD money is going to run out. I mean, right? that the system is so strained that if they want to make a living doing this, they're going to have to definitely refine it. And also, if we want to continue to grow as a field, I think that we're going to continue to stay in our box. And, you know, stagnation is the slow death of any discipline. You have to continue to grow and expand if you want to continue to get
Absolutely.
Better and improve.
Let me give
and get,
you an example
get greater
of
acceptance.
Some extreme cases. And they're not extreme because they may sound extreme to you all, but these are the kind of cases that I get called in for, right? The fire starters, the feces smearers. So Dr. Tim Vollmer and I were called in to work on a case and that was a young lady, 16 years old. She was diagnosed with autism. That was it. But here's the problems. She started stripping. Well, you're 16 and you're stripping. That's not cool. Right, in public school. So they put her in her own, portable, you know, classroom by herself with two paraprofessionals coming and going all day. Dr. Vollmer and I were taking data. We were there hours and hours, right? We were taking data, we were comparing notes, we're talking about what's going on. And we're like, you know what? These doctor's reports don't make any sense. This is not making any sense. She's having 3 menses a month, and the doctors are saying that's part of autism. What? That's not in the medical manuals. That's not in the DSM, right? So do you see what I'm saying? Like, we got these wacky reports from physicians, and the school was like, well, we don't know what to do other than put her on her own portable. We push. Third doctor later, do you know what we found? We, as a team, Dr. Vollmer and I didn't find it. We just took the data and gave it to the doctor. There was a brain tumor.
Oh, wow.
She had a brain tumor.
So like where it was located was
a pituitary
gland. Whole...
She wow. was having headaches. She was stripping.
That's wild, yeah.
She wasn't communicating about her headaches.
That so does like, that does kind of force the highlight reel here that we need to be aware of medical problems too, right? That not necessarily, you know, yeah.
And so I was called to a consult, and I travel internationally. I was at a consult in Scotland. Please come help us. Please come help us. I go over there. Little Lynn is acting like a cat, right? She's feral. And I look at this, and they are all telling me it's for attention. I look at her trauma score. She has 6 out of 10. This child has witnessed abuse. She's been abused. Parents are in jail. Substance abuse everywhere. Poverty. I was like, no, you're giving her a lot of attention. This child is escaping, and she has attachment issues. We've got to get her some mental health therapy ASAP.
What's this scale you're referencing?
Okay.
Yeah, I gotta get know more about this.
Yeah. So the Adverse Childhood Experiences Scale, ACEs. Adverse Childhood Experiences, ACES. I can send you a copy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it, like I said, it's been around since 1998. Now, the states like mine in Tennessee, we're actually making it part of our medical plan. We are doing ACES scores in our communities and directly relating it to how much money we are spending in Medicare and Medicaid in our state, because the trauma-related events are related to these high occurrences of physical illness, diabetes, heart attack, stroke.
What's it based on? What's the validity and reliability behind it as far as the research goes?
Yeah, Kaiser Permanente, okay. And there's some doctors from Kaiser did the study back in 98. I can definitely send you the link, and we can put it down at the bottom of the podcast.
Yeah, I would love to include that for people to check it out. Yeah, it's. I have to say that trauma has become kind of a buzzword that, just on a personal note, I always respond to suspiciously, because I just think it's one of those things that people kind of use it a little bit too frivolously.
Probably.
You know what I mean? It's not.
You're
it's
right.
not.
Right.
It's a pretty substantive thing, you know, and
if that happens, it starts to devalue it for everybody else. So it's just very messy.
Exactly. That's why I think everything you're saying here is totally legit. That's not what I'm questioning. I'm just saying in general, just as far as like in casual conversation and just everyday talk, when that word gets thrown around a lot of the time, or on the flip side too, sometimes it gets used as a way to abdicate the need to further investigate, because if you can chuck it up to that, then, you know, it's almost kind of out of your hands, and it's a way to kind of
And on the flip side, how many times have I sat at a meeting when people want to put all the function of the behavior on attention?
Right,
so
yeah.
easy. Let's call it
all
attention.
Yeah, it goes both ways for sure. Absolutely. Well, I mean, and just Yeah, and that's why I don't even honestly, like, this is a different episode too, but we're definitely going to do a conversation on synthesized contingencies, because that is definitely, you know, I've been doing ISCA for over a year now, year and a half, and as a functional analysis, and it's been millions of times more effective than any type of standard functional analysis I've ever done in terms of isolated contingencies. Years.
Absolutely.
So we're going to have that. We're going to have that conversation. I know Ryan wants to have that conversation. So I think what you're really saying is, when's the last time you found a human being that was raised in a vacuum where they didn't contact complex consequences,
right?
Where that their controlling variables on their behavior weren't multiple, right?
Exactly.
We will have to pull into that discussion Gold Diamond's constructional interview, which was also lost in the field, which was getting at those same sort of
issues. So guys,
issues.
What I have done is I've taken Greg Hanley's open-ended interview and I combine it with the ACES score. It's part of my interview process. I need to find out, because I've found that people withhold information, not on purpose, but they don't know what's important.
Yeah. Well, and they're lying.
And that was what part of that.
I mean, listen, if you're a physician, one of the first things you learn, if you're helping for people, malingering is a thing for a reason. People
is
lie.
A thing. Usually all right, criminals,
so,
but
and they're liars. And whether it's shame, whether it's whatever, they're liars. So I mean, like, yeah, of course they withhold. And again, not all of it is intentional, but
so we have the practical, like, you know, you as a practitioner, you're finding these sort of tools and moving forward with them. You said you can provide us with some links. Are there, like, active sources where you see researchers pulling these things together? Like, is this coming from Vollmer? Is Vollmer's lab still doing this sort of work?
No, so I'm definitely talking about the researchers at Harvard. So for the Center for Developing Child, okay, at Harvard, I am a big fan of what they're doing, okay? And I also want you to consider looking at what's going on with NIH, some of the studies that they're putting out for the child and adolescent mental health, and I'll send you that information as well. Some of the ways that we know when early childhood for little ones, when behavior is going sideways and it's not about social contingencies, when it's about something else, something's going on in the wiring of their brain, is when you've got these dysregulated moods. Things like very easily upset, crying all night long, frequently crying, difficulty sleeping, picky eaters. Can you believe that? Duke did a study, found out that picky eaters actually is an early sign of mood disorder.
So what do you say? What do you say to those behavior analysts that would be like, drugs? Drugs are bad. Okay.
Like, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, well, I you know, because I've run into a lot of people who are very anti-medication because they think that we can operantly control everything, which I believe that. Anyway, I'll let you go. You go, and
yeah,
then I'll go. But
absolutely. Let me jump in on it. You know what? I'm not afraid of any discussion or any question.
Yeah. Well,
but,
I think that's the conversation people are having
we
behind closed doors. Let's
this.
Have it. You know what I mean?
So I attended an AVA conference in Chicago several years ago, and they had a gentleman there who wrote a book, A Nation on Medication, and I bought it. And it impacted my world, right? So when I was at Vanderbilt, I studied behavioral pharmacology. I was injecting anti-epileptics into rats and studying their positive and negative responses. So that was kind of my field. What's going on with all this pharmacology back in the 90s, right? Like, why are we medicating our kids? What's happening? Now, guys, I'm going to let the conversation turn a little serious, something that I don't usually talk about. I have a son who would be 30, but he passed away 11 years ago. Yeah, he had an undiagnosed mood disorder, and he was taking medication that was not a match for him. But we don't test that, do we? Not in this country. We don't draw blood tests. We don't test it on children. And now it has a black box warning. He was on Zoloft, and it was too much. Toxicology report was sent to us that his heart serum level was 10 times the therapeutic effect, and he wasn't even taking it regularly. So he wasn't metabolizing it. So so that's part of that personal story. So you would think that my answer would be absolutely no medication, right? No, I'm not of that strain, because I've seen so many people suffering with schizophrenia, paranoia.
Have you seen that new genetic test that they're doing?
Yes,
swab?
Pharmacogenetics. I've worked with it. I've been a part of this.
Okay.
Yeah, so Johns Hopkins back a few years ago.
First of all, that's an insane story. I can't even imagine. Like, I have goosebumps and my stomach sink immediately. The fact that you fight and push on is, like, awesome. Hell yeah. That's what we need. Like, we need change agents pushing this stuff forward.
No, but that is not to say that I don't believe in it, right? I have seen it help. So those measurements, right, and testing it, and I recommend the pharmacogenetic test all the time.
So, that's what I was going to say. Like, what is this? Can you describe this to me?
So what it is a swab on the cheek. And you can send it off, and sometimes the insurance companies will cover it. I have been able to convince school districts to pay for it. When we've got kids scratching their eyes out or banging their heads and passing out, right, for extreme cases, I've been able to convince the school district to pay for a pharmacogenetic test. And it'll usually tell the psychiatrist, wait a minute, that kiddo can't metabolize Prozac, or it's metabolizing too fast. And so instead of 2 years trying to figure out what med matches, you go right to the right match and right dosage.
Okay. Dimitri, it sounds like you've read on this too, yeah?
I've been in doctor's appointments with where we talk about it, so I've heard it from directly from psychiatrists.
Okay, and anything to add to that process? I've just never heard of it, so I'm trying to gather from you.
It's fantastic, actually, because obviously no test like that is perfect, but what it does is it tests for what genetic predisposition you have towards certain chemical reactions. So they're able to just isolate where you're exactly, like Tina said, what your metabolism rates are, you know, what contraindications you might have towards certain types of drug or compounds versus others. And it really gives them a better chance at picking the right drug is what it does. And again, it's not perfect. It's definitely not perfect, but it's definitely exponentially better, for sure. Exponentially better than because up until now, I mean, I spent, again, back to Tina, we were talking about severe behavior before, you know, and mental health. Like, when I worked in mental health, I spent 4 years going to every single psych appointment for every single one of my clients. And I sat there and listened to them talk. And
that builds your capacity, right?
I know. What an education. Shout out Dr. Ramadan, the man, the legend. But what I would say is that it is very much dependent on the quality of the physician for a long time and their experience and understanding the chemical interactions that occur in the person. So it's a lot more of an art.
Yeah,
it's a lot more art than it is science, unfortunately. Yeah, they are definitely practicing medicine when they're doing,
you know. I lucked out with a child psychiatrist who really wanted to help this one child who had been adopted from South America, traumatized over and over again, abused. And all he wanted to do was scratch his eyes out. Just bloody, bloody, bloody face, right? Yeah. And this doctor was just willing to do anything to help him. And this is back in 2012, right? And so the pharmacogenetic test was new. And he wouldn't take it. No med compliance. Parents wouldn't make him take it. Adoptive parents. So what she did was she prescribed it to be given at school. So school hours, right? Oh, okay, parents aren't going to do this. Then it has to be given at 10 a.m. He's in school, give him at 10. And let's find out what med works. Boom, boom, boom. It was like magic. For us, this child was saved by having that pharmacogenetic test done.
I really think
the competence of that psychiatrist is really high.
Yeah, the mood disorder thing, it's one of those things where I really hesitate to go too far on a rant because, you know, there's definitely gonna be those people in the comments that are gonna like totally smack me for it from a behavioral point of view. But I do agree, and I'm also not a mega advocate for drugs, but I do think that everything has its place, right? Every tool, no matter what it is, has its place. And I don't think that we should be in the business of advocating for anything like that. We should definitely just be exposing people and letting them know that there are medical components at times that need to be addressed to prime people too. Because back to the mood disorder thing, I've also worked with people with comorbidity is an issue, isn't a thing for what we do, period. You just have to accept the reality of comorbidity, right? Especially when we're talking about mood disorders and that kind of stuff and the explosive behaviors that can come from it, especially with unsophisticated learners with no vocal repertoire, right? And when it boils down to it, if there is a chemical imbalance, that there's an issue there with the actual system itself being able to regulate in general. And if anything, it puts people more in a state of responsiveness to behavioral intervention rather than necessarily masking behavior or even necessarily sedating them. But again, that's saying that without completely advocating for everybody to go talk about drugs now, because that is definitely not everyone's scope. It's not even my scope. I very explicitly don't talk about this stuff I just say you need to talk to your doctor. I am not a doctor. Like, we're not going to do this. But it's important to be very aware of it. You know, you have to know what you're talking about when it comes to psychopharmacology, especially if you deal on the more intensive end of the spectrum. Absolutely. In general. And I don't mean just autism spectrum. I mean intensive behavioral spectrum.
Well, I love what you said about the state of responsiveness. That's it, right? Now, let's not talk about mood disorder. Let's talk about a toothache. I got a toothache, and I don't want to learn.
Yeah.
But if I get Tylenol the tooth helps, pulled, right? If I take some Tylenol, I get the tooth pulled, have a medical procedure, I'm going to be in a better state of responsiveness.
Right. I totally agree with that. I think it's a very big reality for what we do. It's just one of those things that you, again, just like anything, just like we're talking about the ACT stuff or any of the mental health stuff, like whenever we start gearing into other disciplines, that's where we have to have that self-awareness to not step over the edge and start talking outside of our scope, you know? So knowing where the line in the sand is, as far as what your scope is really critical for this to be a meaningful thing. That's an important caveat
to hit on that there. Competence means that you can do it, and scope means whether or not is within what you should be doing, right? Sure. Would you say I had one other point? Damn.
Talking to me or Tina?
You, Dimitri.
Just talking about being aware that we need to make sure that we don't go over the line and start becoming, then we start relying on it too. Yeah,
thank you. So in a sense, I think, I wonder, I don't have data on this, is the point here, is I wonder how much our past being very overambitious on where we could do and who we could help, if that kind of laid the ground for these issues now, right? Like, we were in mental health, we were talking about, and we were in these areas, but we know CBT, the second wave, like, rose up, whooped behavior analysts' asses when it comes to PR and the at least perceived effects that it could help. Some ways it is better, we know this, but other ways it's not. And I wonder if that's why we don't have a seat at the table. I was reviewing an article for a journal. I don't know how much I'm allowed to say when I do those sort of things. It's new to me. But they were talking about open educational resources and how little there is in behavior analysis, how much there is in psychology. We're talking about tens of thousands of multiple more of non-behavior analytic resources. But what was crazy is there's more open educational resource, which is defined as like anybody can take, create, use, share it, whatever, you can modify it in your own way, something online essentially that you can use like that. There's more behavior analytic, non-behavior analytic resources talking about behavior analysis in wrong ways, and there are behavior analytic resources talking about behavior analysis in the right ways that are available out there. Like the disconnect in what's going on, right? Like, we need to come together in the field.
Can I just tell you how many times I'm so sick of hearing certain conversations and other types of areas of discussion, like even in politics when they talk about constructivism in general, and they talk about, if Skinner gets brought up, they always confuse radical behaviorism, methodological behaviorism, and it's almost intentional where they put us in that mechanist box.
Yeah.
It makes me so mad because it's so uninformed.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right.
I'm referencing free things in this very limited, specific definition of things that, like, for example, the YouTube videos I make, that's not an open educational resource because it is technically a link that is copyrighted and owned by the Daily BA, right? Like, I'm talking about those sort of, like, so free resources. There's more of them inaccurately than there are about accurate ones by behavior analysts. It's insane. Like, I think the issue, for me, the issue, all of these come down to, like, we have the ability to work in these areas with the right training and the right focus. The question is, how do we design a system to be able to do that? And we have to have the right people at the discussion for that to happen. Like, we have to connect our professional organizations with our certifying bodies, with our licensure boards. And you're talking about an insane amount of work, but you now have to also think about, how do we communicate that to the people that are in new media and doing things like that in our field and outside of our field? Tell them about
practicalfunctionalassessment.com, where all the materials are completely free for the interview informed synthesized contingency analysis by Greg Hanley.
If I talk to one more BCBA who's never used the ISCA, if I talk to the open ended interview, I'm like, why are you using the old one? What are you doing?
It's completely free and available, courtesy of him.
Yeah, right.
So that's if people like him doing that work, You have people who actually do the substantive research giving it away.
Right. And by the way, he's so easy to listen to because he makes all of his jargon people friendly, right? It's not just for scientists.
And I think that would fall under the definition of an OER, but it's probably not being picked up in the major databases if you're not submitting it that way. It depends. So there's a part of this that there are, my point here is that there are things that are available that kind of fit that definition functionally that aren't being caught in like the numbers that I provided. It was 63 open educational resources. That was it. That's all we had. 63 things in the world that talk about behavior analysis
that you can go pick up, learn from, and iterate off of. Doesn't this like raise a pretty interesting question though, in that is it possible that the entrepreneurial spirit in the members of our field has inhibited our ability to properly disseminate and generally gain wide acceptance because it's almost intentionally self-limiting?
Yeah, and here's my thing. Like, I get hit on this before. I think I was asked to comment on that paper because of some of the work I do, but also I've been hit on this before. They're saying, why don't you put them in the Creative Commons? Well, first of all, it's a lot of work. I'm cool doing the work, so that's a bad excuse. But I have to do a little bit of paperwork to make that happen. And I'm talking about like I'm burning midnight oil just to get something up as often as I'd like to. That is a personal decision on myself. But the other thing is, and what I knew happened, but I didn't realize how much this happened, is people will make something and they're being pulled into these online training programs or the in-person online programs as well. And they're being utilized for people to go learn from. And there's two things here, like using it as a supplemental, go check this out, whatever, that's cool. My big disclaimer on stuff I put out is like, this is not an educational thing. This is not sequenced. This is not designed to be this. Like, you can't be doing this. And I've seen from the inside that they're being used that way. And there's a reason that some people make these things that are privatized that way. So, my point there, man, is like, again, like if we got everybody on the table and said, who's going to create what and how would this work? I think you could figure out the financial side enough to where people could all benefit and you would have a tool out there that was actually appropriately designed and being used for the right thing. Because I don't know if the YouTube taught me one thing is the more quantity you put out and if the quality is there to an extent, people will pick it up and it's not and it'll be used in ways that which you didn't intend to. I'm not surprised, but like, I don't know, it baffles me.
I mean, yeah, use and abuse is I think use and abuse becomes the reason, the argument against that. But I also think that use and abuse becomes the reason to perpetuate, you know, the personal motive and not doing it too. So it's kind of a double-edged sword there, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
I guess for me, like on the back end of YouTube, for example, I just have to hop in and I have to click a button and I have to switch it over to Creative Commons. The thing is people take advantage of that even more. And I don't personally, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know, it's linked there. You can use it whether or not it's like in that mode. So like, I don't care, you know, like it's on the internet. The internet for me is like, it's there. Use it.
Right. Well, I'm using it in a way that's just for dissemination. I have a Facebook page called Clinician with a Mission. And I'll tell you how I came up with that on another day. And what I do is I am operationalizing mental illness behaviors. Now, what is that called in the medical field? They're called symptoms, y'all. Symptoms are behaviors. What are if you take medication and you are experiencing a side effect? Side effects are behaviors. So I think we've forgotten that. So I keep reminding people, this is kind of my mission, right? Like if you have dry mouth because you're taking a certain med, that can be counted and measured, right? So I really want everyone to start understanding what symptoms are, what side effects are. They are behaviors. We are not afraid of that. We know how to count them. We know how to measure them. And here's the other part that I just wanted to say on my talking point is that I know when it's outside of my scope, my competence of practice, right? What I know, and I know how to refer. I have a list of referrals for speech people. I don't replace a speech person. I don't replace a special ed teacher. I'm not signing up for 40 hours to do teaching. Yeah. I have schools and I know clinics that will do that, right? I know mental health and psychiatrists. I have a list of referrals, but I am part of that team. I am part of the wraparound.
Yeah, those are awesome strategies and tools. You have me thinking, like for the academics in the situation that may be listening, and they're the ones creating these practitioners, right? Like there's only so much time. Does this turn into like we need to start lengthening the training time like a medical model does?
Or subspecialty like the medical model? Residencies, fellowships?
I don't know. It's already in the task list. I don't think they're spending any time on it.
Well, I mean, yeah, and part of my thing is, I guess I have some, I agree with that. I think
the task list is such a nebulous topic. So
Least let's start there. I mean, when's the last time you went into an ABA class and they were talking about pharmacology or sleep disorders?
Yeah. You have to go to a very specific one.
If I gave you what I thought on that, we'd start a Facebook fire. So we're not going to go there yet. Let's save that one for another day.
Well, I think we need to raise the bar on what they're teaching. And they need to stick to the task list first. And then we could do subspecialties, but at least do the task list.
Yeah, I agree. And
clean it up for sure.
So my question from the systems perspective was, is there adequate enough time given all the pressures on those sort of people? And I start to think that... like for me in graduate school, I could tackle all those and I had professors that would help me with those, but I slept sometimes an average of 2.5 hours per day, per week, throughout the week for like months on end. And it was just so that I could have all the opportunities that were afforded to me and take advantage of them. So I'm questioning whether or not, like, is this a time where we start talking about fracturing out more? Like, why don't we have experimental programs that are, you know, 3, 4, 5 years? In a sense, I feel like the programs that started had a little bit of a duty to start to figure these sort of things out on their own. Like,
I'm going
to
tell you what, Ryan, I have an answer. I do. I've written an RBT curriculum, wrote it for myself. I do sell it to companies just to help them out to defray the cost of training. Let me tell you something. In my RBT curriculum, they spend 1 hour learning about sleep disorders and all the interventions, and they spend another hour learning about what's going on with pharmacology. From BCBAs in the field, okay? So if I'm doing that for RBTs and they are passing, every single one passed the exam the first time, this is crazy. If I'm doing that, little old me, I'm saying they could do it. You're just not putting the effort in it. Sorry.
Yeah. No, there's nothing to apologize for. I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, let's just go there. I don't care. Screw it. I have no aspirations here for academic career, so let's just set them on fire.
Free. It's the reality is this, is that
higher ed is geared too much towards personality and a lot less towards substance, quite frankly. People give a shit a lot more about their graduate lineage, okay, and who their great academic grandfather was or grandmother was versus what they actually learned in all earnestness. And the way labs are structured and set up, they're set up to follow whatever interest area that person is determined is required, you know, for whatever thing they're trying to publish at any given moment. It's not designed to necessarily produce a certain level tiered practitioner per se. Like if we were to make the analogy to the MD model, right, where you have your rotations and they're not there. You're not there to just follow their research. You're there to walk out with a complete understanding of the techniques and everything that you have to do in order to be a competent physician. So I think if you, that comparison, and I think that difference is, it makes it difficult to have a conversation about what our goals are even in academia, right? And like what our goals are in terms of practice. And maybe there is a serious distinction between what the outcomes are like in an academic framework versus what the outcomes are in an applied framework, right? So you have to look at those two things and say, which, you know, if you're coming out of the ivory tower with that focus, but then you're going to practice like a physician, you know, should your training be geared towards that or not? And there's actually a Pritchard article. What's it called? Like the icing on the cake or something.
Yeah. I can't.
We talked about it. Didn't we talk about it, Ryan?
We did, but not on, that was a test episode.
So right. Okay. So there's a Pritchard article actually, where he talks about, you know, maybe we need to talk about having an applied program track versus a research oriented program track so that people can determine what type of education they get and so that their education is tailored towards those outcomes.
And there's models out there. I had a really close friend for a little while that was in physical therapy, and they had a rotation, 4 different places that you had to go with 4 different types of populations and 4 different settings and environments. And that was required to be able to go out and complete your degree requirements, which our field would just lose it if you told people that you had to move across the country for your practicum for 6 months or something like that. But the quality and breadth of their experience and them learning, we saw this also in the adult intellectual disability job programs where we were helping them out. You don't know what you don't know. You get told that things might be interesting to you. You might have an inkling, right? Like you might have had that one person that you worked with and you're like, I want to go do this forever. But when you actually jump in that environment for 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 weeks, you'll get a totally different perspective of what it was, right? We had so many people that in the intellectual disability world that would say like, you know, I want to be a fireman, I want to be a policeman or something like that. You'd go out there and you do a job shadow for a day and they're like, this is the worst damn thing I've ever experienced. Get me out of here. And it was because of what they were told, right? And like what influenced them as like the typical jobs, not the actual circumstances. And behavior analysts don't get that. Like we did not program that in. The very field of programming instruction did not program instruction to be able to ensure these sort of outcomes.
Well, and I think that happened to be part of the old school where I got that. But because my instructors did it on purpose, they weren't mandated to do that. So I'm in the lab, organizational structures. I'm in classrooms, I'm in residential communities, and I haven't even left graduate school yet, right? And so I'm in all of these different practicums, if you will. But I want to say this, you guys, look how much we've grown, and it's been a painful growth in the last 20 years, okay? Since the BACB was established in 98, it's been painful, okay? And we grew too fast. And we got a little sloppy. We let a lot of people pass when they shouldn't have been passing, right? And the other part is, guys, the insurance, whatever, however good-natured that was, there's a great equilibrium happening and it's sweeping across the country and it started in Florida. They are not going to allow this to happen anymore. They're going to separate it out, the educational goals from the medical necessity goals. A great equilibrium is coming and we got to be ready for it. We're going to go back to our roots. We're going to be out there helping people who have a medical necessity.
Yeah, that goes back to I was going to say something about the structural piece, because a lot of the thing I think also has to do with what expectation people have of what their job of a BCBA is in its whole, is that most people look at it as being someone who trains and manages a team of unsophisticated practitioners, or at least like, you know, less uneducated. Oh man, how do I say this without offending somebody? People without formal education, but on the job training and without advanced education doing it, rather than thinking of themselves as a service provider, you know, directly and the way like a speech path would, because arguably speech path has more education than a behavior analyst and it's a lot harder to get into their programs, and they provide the direct service as a licensed professional. Social workers do the same thing. So, I mean, like, you know, mental psychologists do the same thing. These are all people at pretty high levels of education providing the direct service. And our model is not that. Our model is you become a leader of people, right? And you have minions that do that, and you just check in on the data occasionally.
But with social workers, they're not asked to do 40 hours per That's client, fair. Right?
Yeah, yeah, 20, 25 usually, yeah.
Yeah, there are a couple comments. Like, there are data that the BACB speak to publicly at conferences about how we've grown faster than most all other professions, similar to our nature. So we have to acknowledge that. I do want to put my... that exponential growth is something that is in a sense like kind of unfathomable to me, like how fast things move. And I think that position that they are in is extremely difficult. So I do want to acknowledge that. I look at it as a systems thing. Again, as always, like I keep saying, like how we have so many passionate people in this field. I feel like that is a matter of prioritizing and trying to figure out who to talk to and who to bring to the table. Like, we do have some of the most brilliant people. Or sometimes maybe we aren't looking to practices that are good at scaling. Like, is there other professionals out
there? That's my thing. I think it's a scale problem. I don't want to make this sound like I'm anti-board. Like, I'm a board certified behavior analyst, obviously. I'm a member of the board. And actually, I think that that's not the board's function. The board's function is to lay out minimal criteria, monitor it, and make sure people are following those expectations and protect consumers. That's their job, isn't to steer the scalability and or structure of every piece of the field, just like you wouldn't expect that from your psych board or anybody else.
Within their definition, it's anyone who consumes behavior analytic supports or something like that.
Sure. I mean, that's an ethical obligation that we all carry, right? Who's your client? Your client is anyone who benefits from your service.
But their,
right?
their mission is beyond, it's the anyone who consumes behavior analytic services.
Okay. Well, I mean, ambition is important, but I mean, like, it's, is that a realistic goal?
Well, are we overstating our, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, are we overstating?
Yeah, I guess I gave him a pass on that. I didn't realize that it was like a standard they should hold themselves to, but whatever.
No. I think it's a fair pass. Sorry, I didn't mean to just derail.
No, you're totally, no, it's a fair point. It's a fair point. But I mean, I guess I don't like, I just have a general disinclination towards putting any type of the weight of movements or like groups of people on a whole on a singular structure. I think individuals need to make decisions on their own to make certain changes and accept certain responsibility for what role they play in these equations. So I think it's a not again, I do have my own hangups with certain things that happen with the task list and the board and all that stuff. And that's a robust conversation to have. But on the flip side, I think it's also not fair to put it all on them too. I think that we need to say, okay, Joe Schmo, BCBA and whatever, or what, you know, whoever you may be in your practice, that kind of thing. Look at your structure and see if you can is there a business model that changes that, right? Is there some type of a systems model that addresses scalability and saying, how do I proactively do that in my business and have the foresight to predict what some of the things are going to happen? Because I guarantee you, again, I don't know a lot about the Florida situation, but it's funny that you brought it up because what I did read about it, I mean, that sounds like a terrifying situation to be in because the degree of uncertainty.
There are two counties who are not able to do anything.
I couldn't imagine being in a situation where I'm no longer able to get a paycheck anymore because everybody who does what I do was such a piece of shit that they had to blow up the system.
Right.
I mean, seriously, right? That's really what we're talking about.
Just to that point about systems, I bet you could ask Aubrey Daniels. Guy has been in the field forever. He could probably help about scalability and system support. Maybe he is.
Or,
I don't know.
I mean, right? Call Silicon Valley. Like, call other people in the field is part of my perspective here. or in other fields, sorry.
Yeah. Definitely. Like, let's reach out.
Like, everybody has something to offer. Even a company that has clearly had problems, like an Uber, they scaled so fast that there are things that they could probably teach an organization or in a field like
good
us.
Point.
And that's kind of my thing, is like there's a lot of valuable perspectives outside of our field. Why don't we build them into our systems? You know, it may even help with our pigeonholed feels that we get sometimes.
So I wanted that goes back to my point I wanted to make is that in 2006, when the U.S. Federal Congress said, you know what, we're going to mandate that ABA be covered under behavioral health, right? Remember, the money that came from that is going to drive the practice. In 2006, you're going to notice the huge shift in literature, a huge shift in the growth of how we grew as an organization and why we became so pigeonholed. Because the money was big and it was huge and people were tapping into it. Now, private equity is just now finding out about it. You know, all these years later, like, what, what's going on? What happened? Right. And now it's going to shift.
$1 billion disability industry. Yeah.
Yeah. And now it's going to shift. Right. And they came on too fast. They came on too slow and they are leaving. And there's going to be a few guys left standing. There are going to be a few companies, just like in software, there'll be a few big companies left standing. And then the rest will be pushed to schools, right? And so...
Yeah. If anyone's wanting to look to learn a little bit more, Matt Norman and Carolyn Cohn wrote up an article on this, talking about that exact... Not the exact... The exact point on that if there are jobs in these areas and if there's that financial focus, right, in some sort of capacity, then you'll start to see the other systems around it.
I mean, money talks and bullshit walks. I mean, that's just
right.
The reality.
I think we're going to have to convince some of these BCBAs that when they leave school, the great equilibrium will happen. They're not going to start out making $65,000 a year. So when the great equilibrium happens, you don't start at a school district making $65,000, right? So that's going to be hard for the ones that come behind us. Because it's not going to be the field of millionaires anymore. right? Man, people have two or three
millionaires. I feel what? Like, man, what job is I am screwing up somewhere. Shit.
Hey, y'all need to go to Florida.
I need to get my brain right. Dang it. Who are these people? You right. bastards. Share.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
My gosh. No, it's I get it. No, I think you're right. There has been seem to be like this bourgeoisie of behavior analysts at the top that have been able to establish themselves for the past three decades, four decades. And yeah, I think that's a pretty reasonable thing to say. But shit, I ain't one of them. Damn, I got to get on that train.
I think you're on the right train. We'll I think you are. Goes.
Yeah, let's all get on
I
it.
I think
let's
you're on the done. Right train.
So you also, why don't we switch gears a little bit? You want to talk about a little of the OBM stuff?
Yeah, let's jump in.
Okay. All right. So you do, you're doing OBM work. And you use the Aubrey Daniels stuff. Could you talk a little bit about what the Abernathy Daniels thing is a little bit? Because I'm not familiar with that system.
Yeah. So they have put out several books on how to measure performance. And they just simply call it performance indicators. And so what I do is, just like I've done in this field, I take the FBA process and I structure it for whatever business I'm working with. I specialize in clinics and helping clinics, get open, number two, stay open past 5 years, because the Small Business Administration tells us that all new businesses across sectors, not just clinics, will close in the first 5 years. Well, we can't have that happening in our field. People need us too much, right? So we need to be able to help people who want to start a business and a practice keep their door open past 5 years. So I take those performance indicators and I individualize them. I find out what the business is, what product they're selling, how they do hiring practices, what they do for rewards, how they do performance indication with their staff, and how they are actually looking at what are the high performers doing, what are the low performers doing, how are they measuring that. And what I find every single time is they're not doing that. So they have high turnover, more than 50% turnover rate. They're not measuring employee performance, and it's just about billables. And these companies do not stay open. They do. Yeah. They close their doors.
It becomes an unsustainable situation. Yeah. It sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one thing
that's relevant is, for whatever reason, you get into the field and you realize that you can impact a lot of people, and that lure of creating your own company and your own thing. And whether it's that you want to be the behavior analyst that has all the control over the contingencies, or you want to take that ownership, whatever it is, there's a difference between running and executing that organization and delivering the services that we usually get in on, right?
And oh, for sure. The skill sets are totally different. Well, I mean, like, the business skill set is totally different than the clinical skill set. I mean, we can talk about how we don't make distinctions between behavior, but we have to talk, context matters, and then we do need to make distinctions.
And there's a book called The E-Myth Revisited. You can sum it up, and it's so simple. Someone falls in love with making pies and giving those pies to people, right? Like the process of making the pies. She opened a business about pies and putting those out there and hated her life. It was not the thing that she wanted to do. The thing was, is it wasn't the quality or the quantity of people necessarily getting their pies and such. It wasn't that process that she loved. She loved the process of making the pies. And that is something that we just don't necessarily emphasize enough of, like, if you're going to be open the business, you're taking on a whole different subset of contingencies, right? And responsibilities. And that's cool. That's awesome. I'm all for it. But
not all my clients decide to open a practice. What ends up happening is about 60% will go ahead and open up a clinic. I just got back from a new site where one of my clients has actually secured space and will be opening in the spring. But then I've got another client who's like, oh, hell no. What I want to do is mentor with you more before I decide if I'm doing that, which is the point, right? Like, you know, let's decide, where do you belong and where do you fit and where's your passion and how do you want to use it? So one of the things that
I started 1 year ago, and it's not that there needs to be a financial incentive per se. I didn't do it for that, but like, there has to be a big incentive for me to want to do that again, because holy shit, was it a lot of work.
Right. Right.
And stress.
I don't know why, but I guess I've always been that BCBA that looks for chaos. So that's where I've found business throughout the years. I look for this failing school system. I look for the one that made the news because they expelled too many kids with disabilities or minorities, right?
My good buddy.
Oh, I'm going to call them because they're having trouble, right?
I've worked in those systems in the past. My good buddy Mark taught me the value of those. Yeah. It is where you have the most room for improvement and you can make such a big change. Yep. Yep. If you're doing good work, they love it. Yep.
And so anyway, then what I do is I advise all of my clients multiple funding sources. So not do I just say it, I teach them how to do it. So yeah, we get set up with insurance and credentialing. We do our homework. We find out what insurers are in their state, put them in touch with the insurance industry. But then I let them know, okay, let's look at some of your school report cards in the surrounding counties where you live. Let's see who's not doing well. Okay. And then I show them how to find the chaos in the public sector and then how to pitch themselves a cold call, right? Then we look at doctor's offices and then we go, okay, where are there the highest rates of disease? What county's got the worst poverty rate? Let's go to those doctor's offices. Right. And then the other source is private. And it's not about cashing in on rich white people so they can pay private fees. It's about making sure that it's affordable for people who don't have that insurance. And you're going to help them get it through the school. But in the meantime, provide some services through a deferred payment model. They got to pay up front for a certain amount of therapy. And you're going to teach them what to do at home, so that therapy is ongoing. So those four funding sources. And I have to tell you, I was hired to go help a company that was failing. They were imploding in Hawaii. I get there and the bookkeeper tells me, oh my God, insurance is our bread and butter and we're not billing enough. And I said, but you've got school contracts. I don't understand. Well, they don't hardly pull in any money. So when I pulled out the books, I started looking at the books. They weren't charging what the agreement was. Yeah, they weren't. The school had said yes, and they weren't charging for it. They were charging billable hours instead of rates for packages of services. Yeah. And then it all flipped, and it became that the school was the higher bill payer and not the insurance. They were just thinking differently about it, right?
Wow, Tina, you're doing a pretty interesting work, I got to say. I like it. But you're teaching chaos, so it's not done all the time. No, but I have to say that like what you're talking about are skills that people from helping professions actually are almost conditioned to think are disgusting, if we're being serious about it. You know what I mean? To them, a lot of the time you run into people who think, well, there's a certain degree of self-righteousness and virtue signaling relating to the idea of profit as if it's a dirty word, right? Or... And asking, where you were put in a position to ask for something, say for a contract or whatever like that, you know what it's I mean? Kinda, they either hesitate or they shy away from it.
That sense of altruism is kind of antithetical to behavior analysis, though.
What do you mean? Yeah. You think so? Oh, yeah. Because of the control?
Because of the control. But the very essence of anything you do is controlled by a consequence. Therefore, totally negates the fact that there's any sort of sense of altruism and like perfectness in the world. My thing is understand the sources of your control and make sure that you can go to bed at night and that you are following the ethical, moral guidelines of our field, et cetera, the people around you.
But just simple things like teaching somebody you only get what you ask for. You know what I mean? That's you get what you ask for. That kind of like, or like, you know your value in relation to a contract and understand negotiation, right? And understand positioning.
Yeah,
I mean,
and I'm not talking about these little chess games matter. Absolutely, it's fair right. market value.
Exactly.
And what
fair
I do
market
personally...
value is exactly right. Fair.
What I've been talking about though also is when I'm dealing with families who right now I have a family who can't afford anything and the school won't pay for anything. They live in another country. The school won't pay. Insurance won't pay. So, I would be willing to give it, but I have experienced that when I give everything away, that people don't show up. There's a lot of people. Yeah, there's no value in it, right?
There's actually a lot of research behind that too, by the way.
So yeah, my school of hard knocks, I've decided that I will still give it, but I'll give it for $15 a week, right? Or $10 a week or $25. Sure. So they have to pay something and then they show up because it's valuable to them. And so, and I don't have regrets about it. And I help a lot of people. and I don't charge for all my time, right? So there's that point. The other side of all of this, right, you guys, is I'm an independent contractor, really not by choice, just by necessity of where I live and not having mandated insurance in our state. But I will say this, though, that I am able to, over time, put aside money and have investments. So I bought property and I have rentals, and it started slow and you build up over time. And that way, when I do have a slow year, I've got my plan B, right? But I think if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you can't have all your eggs in one basket. Well, that means someone else is paying your bills. You have got to do something that's investing on the side.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, diversification is pretty critical in these areas. And revenue, multiple revenue streams. If you're going to be on your own, you got to have all that stuff going on.
Yeah, I was sharing before we, I don't know if it's included, I'm going to assume not, before we hit record, officially, that was a goal that I had set for myself like 4 years ago, 3 years ago, I think. What is this, 2019? That was 4 years ago, where I heard multiple times, like, this is something you should be doing. And I was experiencing it in two different ways beforehand. Like, I experienced it. I knew it was an important thing to do in business. And we focused on it when we started up the center in 2013 in Orlando, Florida. But also when I, 2014 to like 18-ish, when I was working at a nonprofit in the Reno area, diversification was huge. And I understood the role there. I hadn't quite understood it from like a personal perspective necessarily. And so I set up a graph to just track weekly what I was making.
Of course you did.
And what that was. And, that damn thing was at zero for so long. And now there's multiple streams and they're variable, but that starts to give you some sort of predictability and you have an idea where you're going.
And when you have those multiple funding streams, here's the perk. It allows you to stay ethical and to do what you love to do.
Yeah, that is the best point that you could possibly bring, right? Financial freedom equals the ability to make whatever choices you want. It's actual freedom. In a capitalist society, financial freedom is real freedom.
Right. Don't get me wrong. I'm not a millionaire, but and I do have a husband. I have a spouse, you know, and you have to have a partner who can share expenses with you, or even if it's a roommate or your parents or whatever. And that's the way to do it. Why do you have to live by yourself to be financially free? Why do you have to be isolated and alone to be financially free? That doesn't make any sense. And so, as an entrepreneur, I live it, I breathe it, and I also advise it to my mentees that I work with. So, Hell yeah.
From one fellow entrepreneur to another, hell yeah, congrats.
But I've been doing this a while, but I want to check in on you in a few years and make sure that you are still doing this, right? I want to see you still
we'll
doing
see.
This.
We'll see. If anything's going to push me out of it, it's going to be it's going to be practices in this field and not a particular person. I get beat down by the fact that our systems don't align like they could. That's the only thing that drives me nuts in this field. I will always do something behavior analytic and oriented and all that sort of stuff, but...
It's hard. Don't get me wrong. There have been days when I'm like, I'm going to sell real estate. I'm out, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, man. But I'm still here.
I had that. I was at that moment this morning, right before we started hitting record on this. I was just like, oh, like, why do I do this? And it's not from the multiple streams or anything. It's from the politics and like the fact that certain people don't get along. It impacts the speed with which we can accomplish other things as a larger community. And that's what drives me nuts, because I'll get tastes of it in certain facets with certain areas, but then not in others. Like, you can see this cooperation occurring in different facets and different aspects of our community. Like, a good one is a real simple one. You want to go to Instagram, you'll find an amazing community for behavior analysts. You want to go to Facebook, you'll find people ripping each other's freaking heads off. You'll find in between there too, but you'll find both of those. It depends on where you're at. You want to find professional organizations that like are open to new ideas and want to cooperate and work with other people. You can find those. You want to find ones that aren't. You can find those as well. Like, I was straight, just like, for lack of a better term, ignored. I think ignored is a good way. Like, local ABA chapter here, like, just have been ignored blatantly. And it's like, that's cool. But like... why? Like, why do we have to not reply to emails? Things that I've literally written that I'm doing now that are successfully moving forward with other partners were ignored or said this is not a thing that we would support because we don't think it has any legs. And that's cool, but like, why can't we just like come back around and have this larger discussion around
what's working, what's not. Put it out there. I mean, why do you think? And we're going to get a little mentalistic here, but there's a lot of ego out there. There's a lot of ego.
Literally took the words out of my mouth. Literally took the words out of my mouth.
The thing that drives me most insane with it is the double standards, I think, and that's what I was experiencing today. Is since you're not so and so, you have to go through this process, and it's like, why? Like, I don't care who you are. We both are here in this system for the same reason, which is to perpetuate the field in a way that we can define that, right? But like pragmatically and ethically, blah, blah, blah. And
when it's those things that drive me nuts. Those kind of experiences, and I still do every day, when I encounter it, I have learned, you know, my ACT trick. Now I know it's called ACT, that I'm thinking, yeah, wait a minute, why are you ghosting me? Why are you gaslighting me? What's happening, right? Yeah. And then being aware of it and then skipping it. You know what? This ain't about me. I'm just going to skip it.
No, and I definitely...
Tina's one of my new favorite people.
to talk in the ACT terms, like I definitely get fused with those things for a little bit, and you can see those things popping up here. I guess the original question you had of like checking on me in a few years is like, I'll be doing something behavior analytic, but it might be like running a workshop in the mountains with 40 people a year.
Dude,
and
I'll like be there. That'd
running
be awesome.
Real estate on the side because I would have like said, you know, screw it with the problems that I keep running into. It's just where can I get some traction and enjoy the science? And I don't know, like in a sense, not that I don't have grand big ideas, and I don't want to sound like the next Facebook or Uber. That's not the idea here. But like, I slowly experience the system and then get beat down by the fact of there's so many politics and egos in the way that it's like, why fight that for a lifetime when you could probably just successfully work with X amount of people in another context or something? And that's what I'm personally going through at this stage of my career.
I think you just made the case for entrepreneurship, though. Like, you just made the case for entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Figure out a way to get enough financial freedom to be able to tell every single other person who's going to stand in your way to go fuck themselves. I mean, there's this scene with John Goodman from this movie, The Gambler, where with Mark Wahlberg, that's amazing, where it's like, what do you want to be able to tell me? Because he lets him borrow all this money. He's a loan shark. He's like, fuck you. I mean, no, but for real, like, that's what you're really saying. Is you're saying is that I'm beholden to all these various institutional structures that are based on this academic model of tenure and, I mean, honestly, like, it's hierarchy, right? Very clear cut bounds of like how you progress, how you earn your spots, that kind of thing. And they become the gatekeepers, and it's not merit based. Okay. It's not a meritocracy. And when you're somebody who is self initiating, you become and competitive, you believe that you should earn what you get, and if you've earned it, it's egregious to not get it. So what I would say is that what you're describing is, if you're entrepreneurial, you get to the point where if they don't give you what you want, you flip them the bird and you do your own thing anyway, and you say thanks a lot for your time, see you next year, and show them your ass. I mean, that's just where I'm at on that thing. Is when I hear that, is that any type of barrier like that to me, or people are going to be uncooperative, that's it. Like, like, screw you, bro. Like, not you, but, you know, that guy.
Yeah. We all read Walden too. Why don't we just sit down and, like, throw that to the wayside and say, could we redesign this a little bit better?
Because Walden 2 is communism, and that's just terrifying.
I'm going to bump into a little bit of mentorship. What I would say to you, Ryan, is absolutely right. Be a part of the solution. Find that circle of people, might be two or three people. Dimitri is one of them. Find that circle of people who's like, hell yeah, let's do this. Yeah. Let's do this.
Yeah, no. And that's why we're here. Part of this podcast was to, these are things that happen day to day in my life. And part of the YouTube binge the last year has been a lot of the good side of things. And it's not that these are the negatives per se, and like, they affect me negatively. I'm fine. Like, I feel great. But they, it's not the full gambit of like the things I like to talk about and how I feel, right?
No, so use I'm that glad energy. That you brought these up. Use that energy. Use it well. Like Martin Luther King said, right? Sometimes anger can be a tool and a very powerful for movement. Right?
So counter control.
Use it. Yeah, definitely.
I love Tina. Rage is my fuel. That's why I live in that zone. My sister and I were having a conversation. God, when were we talking? I want to say over Christmas. We're talking, we're like, man, you know what? Because we're Greek and whatever, and I'm an intense person. We're like, you know, I think I'm pretty much always at about an 8.5. So I think that's why like I scare people sometimes. It's
running hot.
It's like my baseline's there. And I kind of need it to be there to be able to keep my head on the ball and be able to continue to do what I do and whatever. But yeah, I absolutely love that.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes spite is a good motivator and sometimes it's a good way to get things done.
And injustice, I agree. I don't disagree with that. And for me in my personal life, making sure that we don't forget about mental health is very important, as you know why now. And I want to be there. I think I can make a change in our field. I can make us recognize the pieces that are missing and that we need to revisit and become those experts and those practitioners for those areas. So
I would love to see that.
Guys, thank you so much for having me today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
It's been a blast getting to know you.
We had a blast. Super fun.
All right. Please, wherever you found this, make sure that you go in, comment, tell us how you liked it. Make sure you answer the questions that we left there. And tell a friend, please, tag, share. It is the way that we can start to break through the barriers and share what behavior analysis has to offer and have these more meaningful conversations in a public sphere. Remember, also, you can go to anchor.fm/thecontroversialexchange and call in and leave your thoughts there as well, again, privately, where we will be choosing some of our favorites to air on the Anchor app. Our next episode is on self-management and narrative. Finding your story, communicating your story, what role it has in behavior analysis, dissemination. I think you're going to like it. It's just Dimitri and I riffing. Now, I have a quick fun fact for you. That is, did you know that 1 in 1,300 people, that's right, in 2018, 1 in 1,300 people that actually tuned into the content chose to support or help out? So I mentioned Patreon before this. Patreon.com/thedailyBA is a values-based system that I set up to where if you're enjoying this, you can go in, you can support for as little as $1 a month, and you get some sort of exchange as well. So some people receive this in a video series where you could watch online, see us talking back and forth. Other cool things include tiers like the Daily BA, the closed like Facebook group where I share other ideas, resources, things like that. Occasionally I get courses, giveaways to hand out to people. We get discount codes that I share with you. I make that super easy to where you can snag some cheaper rates to big events in behavior analysis. And I've paired up with an amazing artist named Lester who makes these just great, phenomenal, really dope posters of legends in our field that we put out there as well. And you can snag some of those depending on your tier. And occasionally I bring on sponsors through this. I make sure that I communicate that with you. And note sponsors, it's only if we truly, truly align on our value system. So that's our show. There are currently over 94 people in the Daily BA Patreon, like closed group that's accessing these sort of things. I'd love for you to join. So really consider going and checking it out. As a gift for signing up, you get access to all the streams from last year of what we actually produce behind the scenes. You can catch Dimitri and I on Twitter at The Controversial X, that's Controversial EX, or on Instagram at The Controversial Exchange. We will be manning these. We will be answering questions and replying and sharing. So that's how you can reach us in between episodes, in addition to Anchor. And to thank you so much to our listeners, you are the reason that we get to do this. The people on Patreon help us support and make it financially possible. But everybody following, liking, and sharing, you all are helping in this grand vision. So thank you. And I have one last thing that I need to read to you, just so that we're all kosher and we're on the same page. And that is, the views expressed during the Controversial Exchange podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast series is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice. That's your Controversial Exchange.
Hey friend, before you go, please just do us one small thing. Tell a friend, tag somebody, share this with another colleague in behavior analysis. That is the best way you can help us grow. Remember, you can call in on the Anchor app, anchor.fm/thecontroversialexchange. We can actually hear you, reply to that, include them in future episodes. So that is the easiest way to get your voice heard. If you'd like it to be anonymous, just state so when you submit it, and we can make sure that it is completely anonymous as well. Now, another way that you can really help this podcast grow is leaving us a review in iTunes, specifically on the podcasting app for Apple. And it just helps us reach more people. So whether you enjoyed it or not, please leave us a review. That feedback is helpful. Now you can find us on social media by searching for The Controversial Exchange. Typically our handle is Controversial Exchange. However, on Twitter, it is Controversial EX, just because we had to shorten that down a little bit. Now, lastly, there are YouTube videos for every single episode now. We are putting them out there. So please make sure you go check that out, especially if you want to see the visual of like what it is and how we're talking about these sort of things. That will be your place. And one last comment, and that is a quick disclaimer. Now, the views expressed during the Controversial Exchange podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to revision, change, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice.